officials in a democracy is to study the issues, listen to the concerns of the public, use their best judgment, make the decision, and then don't duck, but try and explain it to people. And if people don't like it, if they think you're out of touch with what their concerns are, they ought to vote you out of office. And the real problems in my mind, if you're trying to take polls on it, for one thing, the people who say that's the way they make up their decision, what my constituents want, it tends to be what my most vocal constituents want, or what the ones with the most clout politically want, or what I think they want. And I was going to say there are lots of issues where gun control issue may be one of them. I'm going to be talking about that in a few days, where the majority of the public believes one way, but a certain number of people vote just on that one issue. And they tend to be on the other side of the issue from where the majority is, but public officials will often go politically for fear of their life. They're going to vote with the majority that cares very deeply about that one issue. Anyway, I always think that the best way we can serve the public is to use our best judgment. Minnesota has elected, in addition to Jesse Ventura, Paul Wellstone and Rod Rams to the U.S. Senate. If you know either one of them, you may know where they stand on the issues. They don't agree on a lot of issues. As a matter of fact, they agree on almost no issues. It makes news when they agree on an issue. Why would Minnesotans vote for such oddball difference candidates? Well, no, Minnesotans are trying to make their choices based on who they think represents their concerns and their values. And I remember people saying when Ronald Reagan was first elected, oh, he's too conservative, but let's give him a chance. Or Paul Wellstone, he's too liberal or too whatever, but he's honest and we like him, let's give him a chance. And I think the public really does look for people who they think will use good judgment. And then again, the public has a chance. That's why we have elections, so people can vote him out of office if they don't like him. But that's my sort of philosophy of how we ought to use our authority as public officials, how we get our accountability in a democracy. But that's just one thing, is one idea to float out there. I'm willing to talk about anything from public policy to politics or anything in between. So does anybody have something to start off with? Question or comments are allowed as well. In the back, yes.
Hi, we're from a state near Minnesota, and we heard that the reason that Ventura got elected to be governor, a lot of Norwegians, of course, live in the state of Minnesota. And when they got the ballot there, it goes down and it says, skip Humphrey. So they skipped him on the ballot and they voted for Ventura.
You were Iowan?
That's a fact.
I think that was I think I heard you. Minnesotans and Iowans have a lot of jokes about the neighboring state, and I think that's a joke I've heard many times from Iowa in the last several months, because our former Attorney General Hubert Humphrey III goes by the nickname of Skip, and so hence the Skip Humphrey. that is one guy. There are lots of Ventura jokes, too, that ones that he starts and others about him. So, anyway.
Yes, I guess this pertains mostly to the national level, but it's unfortunate that we have spend so much money. You know, candidates are, it seems like the more money they have, the better chance they have of getting in rather than supposedly being a statesman.
Yes, that's a very good point. I'm actually doing a whole talk on that one too on Thursday, I believe. But politics and money are, it's always been a problem, but it's getting a lot worse. I have a quote from a Republican senator from Montana in 1926 talking about how money is corrupting the political process. And basically, I happen to think, and I'm speaking from a Minnesota perspective, but I think it's largely true around the country with some clear exceptions, but a vast majority of people of both major parties, or now in Minnesota, all three major parties, are honest and honorable people. They're not trying to be bought, and if you took an envelope of $1,000 in cash and tried to slip it to them and say, you know, I'd appreciate your help on this, vast majority, 95, I hope 99, or closer to 100% would take off in horror and get away from you as fast as they could. But they also don't understand there's something short of pure bribery where money talks. And Bill Moyers, the journalist wrote a story article last year, big money impact or big money's harm on our democracy is not as bad as you think, period. It's worse. And it's true. It's not outright, we give you money for this, but money influences both who gets elected. People with more interests, with more financial clout, have better say in who, first of all, runs for office, who gets elected, and once they're in office, they have easy access. They may not buy votes, but they certainly buy access, and access buys influence. And one of the issues I spent a lot of time about is stadium financing, which I know Washington State's going through the same thing. There's the bell. It's ringing again to tell us it's time to start. Welcome as you come in. In any case, I was going to say that in that issue, and I've been strongly concerned about it, it seems to keep coming back. If the voters say no, it comes back again. The same thing happened in Washington State, both in football and in baseball. But in Minnesota, we've had a hockey one, we've had a basketball one, we've got a baseball one coming back for the second or third time, we're going to have football coming sooner or later. And the owner of the baseball team, like the owners of most of the teams, is a very wealthy person, a billionaire who came in and wanted a major subsidy. And you can make arguments for and against it, and I don't care to get into that unless there's questions on it, but the owner of the team in this case made sizable financial contributions in 1996 to both major parties. I'm not talking about candidates from both parties. Many of you may be independent voters, and if you're politically active and you make contributions, you might give to this Democrat and that Republican, vice versa. I highly doubt any of you actually give money to two people running against each other. And I highly, highly doubt anybody gives money to the Republican Party because I'm basically a Republican. And then, on the other hand, you know, I kind of like the Democrats too. I'll give money to the Democratic Party. But why do you give money to both parties? The owner's son said, well, it was a bipartisan sort of issue, which I attributed to he was trying to buy both parties. But it's, again, it's not that people are selling votes for money. It's the corrupting influence on good people is that we're human beings and you know, we're taught as children to be grateful. If somebody gives you something, you write them a thank you note. Politics is the one area where we pretend as if it has no impact on us whatsoever. I'd argue it's corrupting both in the way it influences people and it determines who runs and who gets elected. So that's a long intro to what I'm going to be talking about in a few days, too. And for those who just came in, this is an intro. This is a chance to ask all the questions that don't fit in any other place. I find out every time I give a talk on a specific subject here, people have. By the way, I always wanted to ask this kind of question, so tonight's a chance to do that. Yes?
How do you discern the difference between what a poll would be and a consensus that you go on?
In terms of where one would, how one would make up their mind about an issue, or
how you would make up your mind, how would you determine that a poll is not consensus or vice versa?
Oh, okay. And what I was trying to say there in that intro comment was that I guess the way I view my responsibility is not to figure out what majority opinion is on something, because I would say the polls are probably the most accurate way. A scientific poll is probably, despite the fact we don't want to agree with them all the time, probably the best way to find out what the majority of people feel on that particular question. How you word the question, whether it's neutrally worded or not, whether that's the right question to ask is an appropriate question too. But I've always felt that my job, my responsibility to my constituents is to use my best judgment, study the issues, listen to their concerns, make up my mind, do what I think is right, and explain it to them. And there are some issues I take stands on that are highly popular, and some I take stands on that are highly unpopular. And I better do a pretty good job of selling why I believe the unpopular thing, or I'm not going to win an election. And I do happen to think we have an obligation as public officials to provide more than fluff. First time I ran, I put about 25 pages of issue papers out. I think my opponent told us in his brochures that he was a former Eagle Scout. Our biggest radio station, WCCO, Good Neighbor Award winner. And his wife endorsed him in a brochure saying what a wonderful guy he was. But where he stood on any issue wasn't there. I don't know that any constituent read every thing I wrote on issues, except I'm sure he did to find out what he could attack me on. But I think it's very important that we do talk about the issues. I think it's very critical we do, and we shouldn't be afraid of where we stand. And, you know, losing an election is not something any politician wants to do, but it's not the end of the world either. I lost one election, by the way. Up there, you had one.
Having been in politics now for 12 years, can you reflect on what it was when you started 12 years ago and what it is now? And are you still proud to be a politician?
If you take polls of where people feel about various occupations, politicians usually rank very low. Lawyers, politicians, used car salesmen rank very low. But I don't think we should be... I guess I want to be proud of what I do, and I'm not, whether the profession is a good one or bad one. Hubert Humphrey, not the one who just ran for office last year in Minnesota, but his father, once said that politics is an honorable profession to use what power you have to serve people, basically. And I think that public service is a noble calling. I think as a Lutheran, I believe very much we all, not just ordained clergy and people with religious occupations, we all have a calling. And I guess I think that public service can be that very much too. Do I think it's a popular profession? No. I think we should be proud of what we do, or we shouldn't be there. And 12 years from now, the other half of your question, 12 years ago, I would suggest that the influence of money has grown in terms of who gets elected at the national level more than, at least in our state, but it has grown everywhere. The amount spent, you can tell, is going up much faster than inflation. The nastiness of things in politics has gone much worse. And don't get this impression there were the good old days either. When you look at early American history and how people attacked each other, it was bloodthirsty politics then too. I think if we could somehow or another eliminate the occupation, one that I have no respect for is the political consultant, meaning the ones who do the media ads and stuff. I think it's a lousy thing. It's kind of, the goal is not to see how nasty you can be. The goal is to see how nasty you can be and make it look like you're being fair and honest and honorable. And I don't see how TV ads or that add anything to our democracy, but 2/3 of the public say they make up their mind on elections based on television.
Referring to the polls, and I have a two-pronged question or statement to make. Between the polls and having to do a public vote on an issue, Washington State has had a few problems there, and we're from Spokane, and we have a few more. But we don't quite understand how the polls can say that, off the top of my head, the president is so popular now. He's got a 75% or a 68% affirmation, when everyone sits around and says, where did this come from? And why also do we vote on a waste plant, for instance, an incinerator? No one wanted it, and yet we got it. They said that we voted for it, and no one knows who voted for it. What happens here? What are we doing?
How you justify what you believe is the public opinion, what the polls are saying?
Yeah.
In general, I mean, the polls are, it's not like there's some grand conspiracy to doctor these things up. Example, I don't see my wife right now, but I think she might be here. There she is. The other day when we were here, before I got ready for my talk on Ventura, she commented on a lot of people here, not Minnesotans necessarily, but I'm sure the same thing in Minnesota, a lot of people here are saying really nice things about Ventura. And she had said something about how she wasn't I'll tell you, I said an hour worth of stuff the other day, some positive, some negative. And she said how a lot of people here actually seem to like Ventura. I said, well, that's true in Minnesota, too. The polls very clearly say 60% now, I think, give him approval rating. We got 37% of the vote in a three-way race to get elected. He's got more popular now than the day he was elected. And yet, people I hang around don't necessarily care for him. Same thing with Bill Clinton. You may be partly geographical. Spokane, Washington probably isn't the Bill Clinton hotspot. There are the circles we hang around. People our age, people of our economic income level, of our interest, of our race, of our whatever, may have a certain position, and others in the country, as hard as it is to believe, have totally different ones. And best example I can give is the worst job of polling, most embarrassing one. You all remember, those of you who are over 50, I'm sure, the Dewey defeats Truman headlines. Chicago Tribune and Harry Truman holding it up. What happened? Well, the polls weren't right, and they were so sure. It wasn't so much that that polling couldn't have been right. They wouldn't have put those papers out if they weren't so convinced based on polling that it would happen. But I think regarding how they did polls back then, sometimes they did polls based on who had telephones, and back then that wasn't a reliable way to get everybody. And now polling is much more sophisticated. It doesn't mean they don't make mistakes. If you look what happened in Minnesota, Jesse Ventura was behind, but he was surging at the last minute. And the thing you couldn't predict is they're polling based on, in those cases, who's likely voters. And people who have never voted in 20 years are not likely voters, and they came out and voted. But polls tend to be, if the questions are asked right, that Bill Clinton is, I wouldn't say well-loved, but I'd say his popularity is up there higher than he would be in many communities. So it's usually more accurate than you'd believe, even though it may be 90-1 in your community against. It just depends on the geographic area and a whole range of other factors. What happened on your sewage treatment issue, I don't know. I was watching 2 years ago when stadium vote on the statewide stadium thing, and I know the rest of the state was very heavily against it, and King County and a couple other places were very slightly for it, but a lot of turnout, and it passed by 50-point-old-something%. But I think you understand how that happens. It's just sometimes different.
I can understand that a little better than I can some of the other things that go on. Everyone in Spokane is saying, do they doctor the polls? Or do they go to just those areas, for instance, New York City and maybe Chicago or somewhere, where they know they're going to get a favorable response?
The reliable polling firms, which would be, I don't want to say every polling firm is reliable. It's a very difficult science, and they do make mistakes. But when different polling firms tend to agree, they're paid good money to do it. And, yes, they do take a lot more sample in New York City than they do in Spokane, but that's because it's many times the population. But it's surprisingly accurate in the long run. The only way we can judge tends to be on elections, which is where it would be least accurate because they judge on likely voters. But you want to know just public opinion. Unfortunately, it's the only way we have of an accurate gauge. I do surveys of constituents at times. I used to, and I'd always write, appreciate extra comments because that was the most useful thing. Telling what you get from there, I mean, you can get whatever you want out of it, but it's not a scientific read.
What's your opinion regarding initiatives that are voter-generated? We've had a number of them in Washington that have substantially changed and altered the whole course of how government is, operates. Both referendums and initiatives.
Okay. And usually they're dealt with together. We've got initiative and referendum as a constitutional amendment proposed in our state right now. It's come up several times before. I personally don't favor it for one reason, and that is that I'm trying to take the money out of politics, and there is no way that you can limit constitutionally, that I can figure out, that you could constitutionally limit the money you put into it. The last referendum I followed in Washington State was the football stadium one, and I've actually read a lot of the Seattle Times articles from Minnesota, and internet does wonderful things for getting access to articles. And if I recall the details, Paul Allen not only paid for the election, I mean, if you want to talk about buying, he paid for the voting booths, the ballot costs, the election judges, paid for the election as part of it. And then from the articles it said, and I, again, those of you who live here, they have a better sense than I, but they said he refused to debate. He never once would debate anywhere. And instead, he outspent his opponents. I calculated this, the paper didn't, outspent his opponents 34-1 and barely squeaked by with it. I have real problems with money controlling elections. I think referendums tend to do that. The other problem with it, in my mind, is it tends to be yes or no. When we were talking about how do you make your mind up, do you go by what the public wants? I can tell you the public wants to pay less taxes. The public also wants to have better schools, more money invested in fighting crime, more money in other things. Is that hypocritical of the public? I don't think so. Those are the ways. I'd rather pay less taxes and have more money for schools and more money for other things too. You can't get both of those. So if you put an initiative on the ballot, spend more for schools, which we do in Minnesota. We do have referenda for local capital improvement things for schools and for excess, for extra money for schools. We have referenda for them, and they usually pass more than half the time. And so people want to spend more for that, but they don't like taxes. And if somebody comes in there saying the state should put at least this percentage of the budget into this issue, you're deciding an overall budget in one issue at a time, and I think that that causes some real problems. In a legislature, which has got more than its share of difficulties as well, you still have the ability to give and take, the debate, the prioritizing, we're going to put more here than there. When you have states that pass conflicting referenda, which California has done in the past, well, which one do you live by? Well, the courts have had, they've been able to sort those things out, but it suggests that it's not necessarily the best way to govern, but, you know, in Minneapolis, they have it. St. Paul, they have it. And so 2 years ago when Minneapolis was doing one on Stadia, I was talking with the people who were pushing the referendum to give comments and whatever. And, you know, if you got the referenda, you might as well use it. But I wouldn't support putting one in place myself.
John, I'm interested in hearing three or two or one success stories of regular sort of grassroots people without a lot of money working for political change and winning. And what went into it? What were the strategies that worked? And how many people did it take? I mean, just from your personal experience of kind of success.
There are all kinds of, I was going to say, Luther's, Snow is talking about a number of these things this week on community involvement in making change. Let me suggest there are several ways it happens. One is just sheer public opinion. I think in Minnesota on stadium issues, that's been sheer public opinion that has changed. I very clearly think it's changed the course of what would happen politically. There are lots of smaller issues where people, trying to think of one off the top of my head, well, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. There are people, by the very nature of their name, they're not all women. I've been a member of MAD. But there are people who were touched in one way or another by drunk driving, usually losing a family member or something. I know a couple members of MAD who themselves have injured or killed somebody as a drunk driver. They were required in the courts to do something about it. They got involved in MAD and they feel passionately about it. You work hard on those issues, you actually see little bits of progress. I think Minnesota's done better than most states in DWI laws. It doesn't take necessarily a large lobby. If there's a large lobby opposed to it, you're going to have trouble. But there are a whole lot of issues where one person, if there was an issue in Minnesota this past year, a woman who had been injured by a defective seatbelt. Under our law, you cannot, it's not admissible in court in a lawsuit whether a seatbelt was being worn or not. And she was, the whole situation there was not whether she was wearing it or not, was whether the seatbelt was defective or not. You couldn't really have a court case without that. She got in there, Ventura vetoed the bill, and she came back. It was, papers made a big story because it was one woman coming in and fighting the government for change, and she won that way. But generally, the small individual person has the best chance if it's not a hot issue with a strong opponent, or they have a very passionately organized case or cause, and it tends to get public sympathy with them, or they just have sheer brute force of a large percentage of the population feeling very vocal about it. Or tragedies occur that change public opinion and change legislative opinion. There's a lot of reaction after a tragedy, usually.
What do you feel about, especially in light of some of the shootings in the nation, and how do you feel politics and religion, morals, and values? How can those two things go together to maybe change some of the things that are happening?
Okay, and then let me ask one a little more about your question. Are you asking how you mentioned school shootings and so on? How changing, making the public have stronger values and so on, how that can change public policy, or how politically things can change because of...
I think I'm of the opinion, I think a number of people are, that part of the a big part of the problem is the morals and values of our nation, and that's why these shootings are happening. And I think the church certainly has a lot to do to change those morals and values.
I think you're right that people's values have a big, I would say that I don't think people in this room have some value that thinks it's okay to go shoot up a school. Teaching values to our kids, how do we best go about doing that? And what do we do about the fact that not everybody does pass on those values? Either because of a dysfunctional family or family teaching lousy values. I think it's a very good question. It's not simply one that can be answered with a quick answer. Politically, the political system may be able to encourage some things, but I'm not sure that we can say, oh, here's what we have to do and we'll teach values. I'm not a supporter of the putting the Ten Commandments in the schools. Partly, my faith is a little more than just 10 rules, and I think the Bible study this morning was talking, and Jane was talking about how she doesn't know a lot of Jewish people. 10 Commandments were given to the Jewish people in covenant, and how many of them are arguing to put them in the public schools? What about the gospel and putting the gospel side of thing in there too? I'm not sure that's the way you promote values. I think the way we promote values, first of all, I think a community like Holden, people here, they ask for volunteers every meal. They're not saying, hey, we're going to pay you for this. I mean, the only time I've ever heard somebody say you get an advantage to volunteering at Holden is for clearing the trail today. They say, hey, you get Snicker bars if you do it. I remember a few years ago we were here, and then we were shoveling snow off the 10-mile creek path because there were some people coming here in wheelchairs the next week, and there was 6 feet of snow. And there were a surprising number of people sweating out there shoveling snow in June so a couple people could use the trail. What passes on those values? I would argue that our kids see us do that. I would argue that they see the neighbors. They watch very closely what adults do. Certainly politicians. What politicians do. Our president and Minnesota's governor have been saying and doing at times. I don't think that sends a very positive message to kids. I think what we're doing in the media, Howard Stern has just been dropped from the Twin Cities radio station that carried him. But, you know, I don't think that's the message we're sending to kids is getting worse and worse every year, and I'm pretty scared about the future that way. Is it government's role to step in and say we can't have outrageous people like Howard Stern on the radio? I think the worst thing we can do is have government be censoring that. There was a federal judge in Florida a couple years ago banned as obscene a CD from some rock group, and that copy sold, I don't know, more than double the previous one. It was like 4 million copies of that album after it had been banned as obscene. It was free publicity for them. Well, maybe one of the things we can do is not buy it ourselves and speak out against it. So I don't think there's a simple way of doing it, but certainly living by example is the best thing any one of us can do. And as institutions of the church and government and other things, I think my favorite high school teacher was a German teacher who, anytime he saw something where somebody was mistreating somebody, he'd stop his German lecture and start talking about how we're supposed to respect and treat others right. And I think you hit the nail on the head. We have to change values and beliefs of people, and that's not something that government can do on its own. It can help that way. Schools can't do it on their own. Parents are probably the biggest single part of it, but you got to help when they don't.
You remember Judd?
Judd?
Senator Judd from Minnesota.
Oh, Representative Judd, yes.
He was one of the most moral, delightful people, and every lecture he made was on this, the moral values that he tries to instill in the work he was doing. Fantastic person.
And there are many honorable people. By the way, the other thing is when you get into the personal sex lives of politicians, which has been very much in the news, both in our, as I said, our Minnesota governor and obviously the nation's president, I always hesitate to say that those should be big campaign issues. I sort of figure that's something people have to decide. Is it totally irrelevant to public policy? Well, it's irrelevant to public policy, but if somebody lies in one aspect, you trust them in another way. But on the other hand, I mean, those who speak the loudest about how good they are and how honorable they are, how do you know? I mean, sometimes they're the best ones at covering it up or hiding it. And I don't think that should be the only, I mean, what do you do if there's somebody who's really, really honorable in every way and then they happen to have some problems in their own personal life, whether it's drug addiction, alcohol addiction perhaps, or some other problem? How much do you weigh that against them? I don't want to tell people that's irrelevant, but I also don't know if it should be the single most important factor. It's a tough one. We're electing people, not saints, to office, and I don't know that there's any politician who is a saint. I don't know if there's any person who's that. So. Yes, Ben.
Coming from a rural area and being affected by the rural crisis, the South Dakota legislature this last year tried to pass a couple of bills and did. Did Minnesota address the rural crisis at all in their legislature during this last year or not?
Minnesota has dealt with rural crisis. I mean, this is a heavily political thing. I mean, which side, how do you deal with the farm issues? People who know something about agriculture know the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union are both farm advocacy groups, and they seldom agree on much of anything on how government should be involved. Matter of fact, I'm proud I get a high rating from one of the groups, and of course the other one then gives you a very low rating. It depends on your philosophy of agriculture that way. Minnesota legislature there was a lot of money in the bank and a lot of tax cuts given out this year, some specific ones to farmers this year. Nevertheless, the agriculture is in serious trouble. I mean, you got to say that in the used to be you'd have farmers had to worry about bad weather and the crop failure and they'd have bad years. Now the good years are the ones the prices fall because there's excess production. We've got serious problems in Minnesota about dairy because of the dairy pricing laws that the federal government has. How far away from a certain community in Wisconsin is, affects the dairy price. Wisconsin, Minnesota dairy farmers are, Minnesota's been losing 3 dairy farmers a week for a good number of years now. And we're slowly putting those businesses out of business. We have big issues in large animal feedlot issues coming up every year, and that's a very contentious issue. But in terms of solving agriculture problems, I think most people in most states, I think I've heard it from all 3 parties in Minnesota, the federal government's got to do more of it. And I mean, if you're from a rural area, you know what your opinion of freedom to farm was and whether it's helped or hurt. But I'm scared for rural communities because they're dying. And farmers are not making it. And we did not do anything that's going to really make a big difference. It was $70 million, I think, in the final bill in terms of property tax relief for farmers. That's not going to make ends meet if they don't otherwise. All right, tonight. Yes, over here.
In your experience, have you seen any trends for change in decision making towards environmental protection rather than economics?
In the last decade, it was during Joe's talk, Joe Whitman's talk earlier today about energy issues. We got a little bit into the public policy of that. About my first year there, I was working with the Isaac Walton League on energy efficient appliances. They had this idea, because the federal government wasn't acting, because the appliance manufacturers opposed it, they had 40 different states introduce similar standards, and the appliance manufacturers had a fit because they didn't want to have a variety of different standards to have to meet, so they decided they'd drop their opposition at the federal level, and it passed. I don't think we could pass much of anything like that in Minnesota these days. I happen to be working on a little bill I hope to introduce next year on 2-cycle engines. I saw a thing last year on, you took 2-cycle engine, somebody in San Francisco, I believe, took a big 250-gallon bin, put a 2-cycle in one and a 4-cycle in the other one, and at the end of 2 hours of nonstop running, one of the tanks was water and the other one was solid, it was toxic waste. Matter of fact, the San Francisco Port Authority people said they'd arrest them if they dumped it into the bay. You know, the motor running there would have done the same thing in 2 hours. They put out so much oil. I mean, you look behind the outboard. I understand people have them, they're going to last, some of them are going to last 40 years yet. But we shouldn't be putting new ones out there. But I guess I think right now the political climate around the country is sort of let's not do more of environmental protection. I think I'd argue that's one area where the public is ahead of the political system in terms of where they want to be and where the political system is. And I'd argue that's partly the influence of money in the political system. Yes, sir.
I bring a legitimate question here.
They're all legitimate. The answers may not be.
Yeah. There's a U.S. congressman in the state of Washington who ran on a platform of a 2-term limit. And his 2 terms are now up. And he's running again. And I guess, or at last I heard, he was still running again. And I wondered what your feeling on that was.
Well, I was going to say that the obvious thing to say is it's a little bit hypocritical to say you're in favor of it, and then when it comes to influence you, it doesn't matter. I have never supported term limits. I happen to think if the people of the United States wanted to re-elect Ronald Reagan a 3rd and 4th and 5th time, which I wouldn't have chosen to do, and so on, I think they should have had the right to do so. That's the only term limits we have nationally. In Minnesota, it seems to be dying down as an issue. I chair the committee that deals with that, and I give it hearings every couple of years, and it gets voted down in my committee, and hey, I have lots of other issues I'd like to pass out of my committee, and I'm not one of those all-powerful committee chairs. Most of the issues I I bring up their who's too, but term limits is one that I've just felt it's not the best way to do it, and I think it's a little bit hypocritical for somebody to go out there and campaign saying they're going to limit two or three terms is what they favor, and then, well, but not for me, or not for just me. If they promised upon getting elected, and I know the guy who beat the Speaker of the House, number, is that 4 years, 6 years ago? Tom Foley's race? Yeah, I knew he had promised. Is his number of years up? Is he the one you were referring to? Or? Yeah. So, okay. So the guy is running again, though? Or at least
that's what I heard the last time. I haven't heard anything for a month or two, but that's what I heard.
That does make a lot of cynicism in political process. The public is already cynical. I hope for the good of the system the guy chooses not to run. And if you don't believe in it, don't make the promise. One of the issues that I think I should raise, and I heard it because I was at a forum in St. Paul a couple weeks ago on one of the new stadium things coming up. The St. Paul mayor is pushing a half-cent increase in the sales tax to put a new one in. And he made a promise. He stood on the Capitol steps last year, signed a pledge, no new taxes. And I've seen the pledge. It comes to me every year. You're going to sign this pledge. You're going to sign this pledge. And it's used against you in the campaigns that you don't. But it says no new taxes. And I don't know how you can say that that's not dishonest. Why do you sign the pledge if you don't do it? He was running for a different office at the time. But, you know, if you should be very cautious about making promises you don't want to keep. And, you know, our new governor, who's been in the news a lot, I was going to say one of the things I'll give him credit for is he said at the beginning. He said before he was elected that he's not going to promise a lot about what he's going to do in office because he still doesn't know the details of office and he reserves the right to change his mind. And he's changed his mind, and that's fine. My only beef about that is he won't admit he changed his mind. He says, you misinterpreted what I said. But I think promises should be not made if you're not going to keep them.
I was just going to say that this particular person said later that he didn't realize the consequences of his promise because he hadn't been in office yet, mm-hmm. and he didn't know how long it took. Now, I think most mm-hmm. of us know how long it takes to get something done, and he should have thought about that at the time. Rather than to say, I promise, he should have said, I disagree with running forever, and I approve term limits, but let's see what happens. And I think he has as much as admitted that he was wrong in doing that, and now he's waiting to see what the public does.
Now that's a tactic Marty Meehan of Massachusetts is using. He promised, he dumped the representative by saying he'd been too long, I will only be there for four terms. Well, the fifth term's coming up. He says, I find that I can be more effective now than I was when I started.
And
so I said,
I've heard, I don't go around campaigning. I'm a powerful committee chair. You got to keep electing me because I can bring home the bacon to the district or whatever. But I'm not sure that's a real powerful campaign plug if it was true. Anyhow, but there's a little bit of difference from somebody who just says, re-elect me because I got the seniority and I got the college, and somebody who says, I won't do this. And I learned my lesson. If you learned your lesson, you probably ought to, for the good of trust in the system, I guess I would hope the individual would step down.
Well, that's how Kennedy used to be elected.
People say they've got a lot of clout, and they do say that, and people, if they vote their way. There, I'm sorry.
How does legal accessibility to firearms have an effect on the general demeanor of the country? And will Americans always have the right to bear arms?
Will it always have? Let me tell you, I don't think I can predict what's going to happen in an election 2 years from now.
Okay.
So I don't want to predict about always for anything. I was going to say that firearms, access to them, and I will give a long talk on firearms in 2 days if you want to hear this. I don't know, one of these days I've got one scheduled. On firearms, I'm happy to go into more detail. I happen to think that we ought to treat firearms, at least like automobiles do. We require training in order to drive a car, and we license you and we register your vehicle. I think we should have some firearms restrictions. And the Constitution does not talk about guns specifically, it talks about arms. And I don't think there's more than 1/40 of 1% of the public who thinks we should be allowed to have nuclear arms as individuals. Machine guns, which have been banned nationally for 60 years or so, I don't think there are many who feel that. The question is where we are now and where we should be. I would argue that the majority does support tougher gun laws. I think it would help some. I don't think we should see tougher gun laws as a panacea that's going to eliminate crime. I think it can help in some cases when you have waiting periods. We've seen people are turned down from getting guns. The individual over here talked about teaching values. I think that's part of it. I think there are a whole range of things we ought to do. Interestingly, I tried about 8 or 9 or 10 years ago. I had a little bill that said that if somebody was convicted of domestic violence, domestic assault, they would lose their right to have a gun for, I don't know, what is it, 5 years, 3 years or something. And in committee, I said how, you know, I kind of thought anybody who was convicted of any violent offense ought to lose their life to have their right to have a gun of any kind forever. And one of my colleagues who is sort of agreed with the NRA on everything said, well, you think that's good? And I said, yeah, I do. I think that's the NRA position. Don't muck around with law-abiding people. Law-abiding people, leave them alone. But the lawbreakers go after him. And this is going after him. So I said, well, I'd be happy to carry that. And so he offered an amendment to do it, passed unanimously, brought on the Senate floor, passed unanimously on the Senate floor. And I think the NRA didn't really like it, and they killed it in the House. But I guess there are certain gun laws that I think would make a difference. I don't think it's going to solve all our problems, but you know, there's a poster, a group in Washington, a handgun control group has a, had one several years ago. It's a red, white, and blue painted pistol, and it says 1993 or whatever year it was, handguns killed 17 people in Japan and 8 in Great Britain and 15 in Canada and 9,800 some in the United States. Clearly, easier access to guns makes it easier for people to use guns in ways that are harmful. I can't see why somebody needs a magazine clip of 15 rounds of ammunition to go hunting or anything. So I think some things like that would help. Is there always going to be a right to bear arms? I would argue for hunting and sports things, it's Olympic sporting events. I don't think that's, in our lifetime, I don't think any of that's going to go away. I do expect there will be tougher gun laws within the next several years. I think this year, even though it didn't happen right after Columbine, there was a lot that did happen that suggests there will be some.
How do you feel about what's going to happen with healthcare and what I see as a real crisis in healthcare, that we don't even cover 40 to 60 million people in this country for healthcare? And there's a greater increase in the number of for-profit ventures in healthcare, which I don't see any place in healthcare. I don't think there should be a free market in healthcare. It doesn't work. Do you see any improvement in the healthcare situation? And how do you battle insurance companies with the huge amount of money they've accumulated?
I talked about 2 years ago to a doctor who is head of physicians for
Social
National Healthcare. Universal healthcare organization, he told me, he said, you know, I think we're going to get universal healthcare faster than I thought. I said, why do you think that? Because the political climate seems to be going the other way. And he said, the system's deteriorating faster than I ever thought it would. I've worked on one little area of that, prescription drug issues, and there was a new study out of Boston University this week pointing out that Americans pay about 40% more than Canadians for identical drugs, identical manufacturers. And those of you who live in California and Arizona and that part of the country know you can buy drugs for a third the price crossing the border into Mexico. And they're not price subsidized in Mexico or Canada. we have no market, no competitive marketplace in prescription drugs in this country. As you said, I'm not sure how you do how the competitive market is going to determine healthcare. I can see how you can sell cars on a competitive market. You can, it's very determinable, measurable types of things. But the reason we regulate insurance is because you had all kinds of people selling life insurance, cancer insurance. Oh, just a few dollars a month, and could you ever qualify for it? Well, one person in 50 million might possibly get a few pennies out of it. But it's easy to have a scam in something that complex. Minnesota, there was a big, quote, healthcare reform initiative, bipartisan thing several years ago. I wasn't real fond of what they did, other than the part of it that was providing more universal care, making it affordable, a sliding fee program for lower income people. In terms of what's going to happen, I think if you take a poll of the public, the poor who are on welfare have their health care provided. People who don't tend to be the low-income working people and retirees who have gaps between Medicare and their costs. And, you know, I don't know many people who don't consider their health care to be one of the most important things they have to deal with. And in prescription drug things, I saw lots of people going to Canada to buy their drugs. We heard testimony of a woman whose husband took one-third of his heart pills because of couldn't afford the refills. That's Minnesota, and we like to think of ourselves as taking good care of people. I think we're going to have health care reform of a different way in a few years. I think we would have had it already, except for the money. You look at, was it the TV ads? I can't think of the name of the two people in it. And I wasn't really fond of the healthcare direction the federal government took either, but the whole nature of the debate. Patients' Bill of Rights is here. I've been sick of hearing all the radio commercials on both sides of that one. Does that really help us make a better healthcare system? I don't think so, and I think we're gonna have the system, it's crashing down by its own weight, and we've used it in our family a lot this year, and we've been pretty fortunate, but we've got a good plan, good coverage, and I happen to think that my constituents should have as good a health care plan as I have.
I was going to ask you that. Do you, you hear comments about the federal government, Congress and Senate of the federal government have perks in that area that are not even considered for the average person?
Well, it's the federal government, yeah, they're all U.S. government officials are allowed to use Walter Reed Medical Center and everything else. Our health plan is the same as public employee health plans. We have the same three or four options. We pay into them a certain percentage. State picks up a pretty good amount. And our kids got braces. I found out that our plan covered both of our kids at the same time to get these things. And when I heard how much other families were paying, because you can see all that, we've been very lucky. But yes, the federal government has better health care than, federal government officials have much better health care than the average citizen. And I'd say half of all Minnesotans, half of about 53%, I think, are covered by health plans that may have bigger deductibles and co-pays than ours, but it's only about 20% or so of the public that has really poor coverage or no coverage. And I happen to think the people we represent should have the same level of health care coverage we have, and it's not close to that now.
Would you go for the government to handle all of this?
What I've argued for would be a privately administered single payer healthcare system.
But
that's highly controversial. Pardon?
Yours is not. Yours is the hand of a state.
Right. Well, I'm saying that what I would like to have happen would be to have a system in which we have one set of healthcare and the government can negotiate prices with people, because I don't think the healthcare reform we had, it was a push towards managed care, and I love the idea of managed care, where I can go to somebody and they can help do this, but managed care, the way it's carried out, has been kind of something other than its managed denial of care in many cases. If talked to doctors who say insurance company employees are telling them how to practice medicine. And that's not what I'd call managed care, and that's what we're getting under Minnesota law and I think under most states. So we've got it. I think that's the growing crisis. I think politically, I think both parties are going to someday say, we're going to have to do something about it because the public is going to demand it. When the question over there, where can the public make a difference? I think we're getting to the point now where we spend far more than any other country in the world per capita in healthcare, far more, and yet we have a significant number of people without affordable healthcare.
John, this is a more simple question than you could answer. Just wondering what role your constituents have in the decisions that you make. I am a teacher in Washington State and spent a lot of time this year contacting my legislatures about salary increases, and most often got form letters back in the mail and always wondered if the secretary just typed my name into some database and sent me that letter back, or what role the things that I had to say in my individually written letter to that person, what effect that had.
Let me suggest that every elected official responds differently to things, but as a general rule, the more effort you put into something, the better the chances are it's going to have an impact per letter. If I get a postcard, dear Senator, fill in the blank, sometimes blank not filled in or spelled wrong or whatever, I strongly believe that you ought to support this, and if you don't do this, something or another, sincerely fill in the blank. First of all, I'm not going to type a personal response to 300 people who send 300 identical postcards. I'm going to have one standard reply to 300 postcards. If you write a note that says, you know, how do you feel about this? Because this is a concern and blah, 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 and I had this experience, and you get that particular kind of response letter, you got to respond yes or no. I mean, you look at the letters. I see what people send out and what people get back, and hey, I write letters too that say, yeah, I appreciate your hearing your concerns, and very few politicians want to tell you, very few people, it's human nature, want to tell you, boy, I strongly disagree with you on this thing. So they'll say, I'll keep your concerns in mind. I will sometimes say, you know, I hear your concern, but feel we should move more this way. With email, make sure when you're contacting a public official, you let them know you're in their area, not, I vote for you, I vote in your district, I'll vote against you, unless threats don't help. But with email, I never know where they're coming from, unless they put their address on saying, I live here, here's my name and address. You get something with all kinds of names, and you don't know if they're from your country. Email is the nature of that, and so let people know where you're from, and the more questions you ask, the more they have to do it. And matter of fact, the one thing I do discourage teachers from doing is having all their kids write and ask a different question of legislators. Because, and again, we do try and respond to them to a certain point, but we have some teachers who I think decide that's a really clever homework assignment. And, you know, taxpayers are paying to respond to those letters. And I don't think it's a real productive thing that way. I think when classes will write a letter saying, you know, we really wonder about why this is the case. But I strongly encourage people to write and call and legislative levels, visit your legislators. They live in the neighborhood often, and let them know your concerns, because frankly, I don't think there are many who are just gonna totally ignore what you have to say. They're gonna disagree with you sometimes, but you do have a say. We have a couple more questions, and then we can, it's about 9:30, so a few more.
Well, this getting back to polling again, is it still done on a random basis? And is it more done in a densely populated area, or that doesn't make any difference?
I'm not a pollster by profession or anything, but they do start out with, generally, nowadays they do often use phone listings. You buy a list, a polling firm buys a list, and they can pick it out of a phone directory out of an area and or whatever. They will usually call from that list, and if they find that the answers, the people who answer the phone are too often female, they will balance it out by getting a roughly, they'll start asking, now is the oldest male in the house yet? or the youngest male in the House, if they got too many female ones, to balance the thing. But the, if they're doing a national poll, they will try and take a national database of things, so they're going to get, if 5-7% of the population lives in California, they're going to try and get 7% of the calls from California, and they're going to try and balance it geographically, so it's by geography. It's designed to be random, and they try and balance the randomness where they think they're not on target. But I'm always impressed by how accurate they end up being, though sometimes I really have trouble believing they could be right. And usually when you see another one and it says the same thing, you begin to think, well, maybe I'm off base on that. Yes.
Speaking from Minnesota perspective, with the current session that just ended, so much of it came crashing down in the last hour. Is that the nature of the beast, or is that my fault for not ringing somebody's phone, or is it the political process? Because I don't think it's unique to politics. It seems like any negotiation is final hour. And
Your last comment is a good part of the explanation. In Minnesota legislative sessions, in whatever year this is, the odd-numbered year, we have longer sessions. They go until, I think, the third Tuesday in May, and they're constitutionally required to end that day, and even-year session is shorter. But it's partly human nature. It's partly the nature of negotiations, and a lot of people who I would argue, I've never played poker, so I don't know what a good poker player is, but I do know when people talk about good poker players in negotiations, some of the ones who talk how they're the best at it are not very good, and one of the main tactics they tend to do is stall, and well, we'll walk out. Our Senate Education Committee chair is notorious for having a fit with the House Education Chair on the Education Conference Committee and walking out for 3 days, and that really helps make the process go well, because then you get it where you have to work through the night. And that's one thing that's improved in my 12 years there. We used to meet through the night. And if you think your people can be irrational in politics, try doing it without any sleep. I'd say that's very poor planning. On the other hand, our prior governor, if you're Minnesotan, our prior governor had complained how the legislature does nothing the first 3 months of the session. Why don't we make the session shorter? I thought, yeah, all we do the first 3 months of the session is have hearings where we have people testify, we study the issues and so on. We don't do any of the voting till the end. Why don't we cut out the first two-thirds and just vote without knowing what we're doing? So there is some merit to having some study time first. I think there really was good political demagoguery, you might say, but I think there's a lot of merit to studying things first. I think we ought to go further the way we've gone in terms of limiting hours, so banning even our conference committees from meeting after midnight, and find a better way to do it that way. I also happen to think we could get rid of that logjam by getting rid of one of the houses of our legislature, which is a whole separate issue, but I think it would make the system much more accountable and much better legislation, not, I think we get worse legislation through two houses, not better, but that would help a lot.
This last one, though, was that
by the way, this is a colleague of mine who just came in the village today, Dave Knutson, who's also a member of the Minnesota Senate, who surprised me this afternoon with his hat on there.
This last session, though, was a result of an inexperienced governor. So when you elect somebody that's never been involved in the political arena, you have the third piece of the stool that doesn't make any decisions and doesn't know what they're doing till the very end. That's what happened in Minnesota this last time.
Yeah, new governor who didn't know where to push. I mean, one of the objections I have to our current system is the only way you get a deal with this is you have a governor and legislative leadership of both houses and both parties sit down together and cut a deal. Okay, we'll get you guys this and you'll get this part, you'll get this. If you have a single legislative body, which I think all the Canadian provinces now have, and every city council except for one or two in our country has one council, not a two-house council, but, you know, one county board. Then you put together things, you bring it up, and you don't have to negotiate. It's who has the majority of the votes in the legislative body. But the nature of the thing is, one body's going to vote for this and the other one's going to vote for that, and the negotiations between them tend to bring it there. And that's where a governor who's got strong leadership skills and experience in how to do it. I think Ventura has never done this. He didn't know any of it and kind of left town near the end, and that didn't help it. It was fishing opener. And in Minnesota, you got to understand, the governor's fishing opener is big stuff. Every governor does it. But anyway, how about two more questions, and then I'm happy to stay around and talk more informally afterwards.
Young people and their interest or lack of interest in politics, how do you see that?
Okay, that's a good point. If you look at demographics of who votes, 80 and over, until they're those who are mobile and able to get out of the home and vote, almost everybody votes. You know, you talk to a whole lot of people. I've voted every election since FDR's first one, you know. They've never missed one. And you get down to people in their 50s and 60s, and there's still pretty high voter turnout. And you get down to the 30s and 40s, it's getting poor. You get down to 20s, it's pathetic. Jesse Ventura actually did bring out many of those folks, including a lot of people who had never voted before, who are my age, 40 years old, roughly, who never voted before or haven't voted in 20 years. And I think the one thing we have to do, the talk earlier about what we're teaching our kids, they learn from their parents. You see all the cynicism. You see the stuff about politicians are all a bunch of crooks. And boy, I think our system has a whole lot of work to do. I said, I think money's corrupting. I think 90-some percent of people of every party that I've ever worked with, both parties, are honorable people who are trying to do a good job. And boy, we fight like cats and dogs and we disagree with each other. But it doesn't deserve the cynicism the public gives. And by preaching cynicism and so on, I think people don't understand the distinction between cynicism and criticism. I like a critical public. People who are really angry about something want to change it. Cynicism is, it's all a rigged deal, it's all crooked, it's all hopeless, it's all whatever, and they don't even bother to vote. And our kids learn from us more than ever, and the 20, 30-year-olds are the ones who've been learning from what they've been hearing for the last 20, 30 years, and they don't bother to vote. And is there a simple solution to getting them involved? No, but I think we all better work at it, because if you have a significant number of the public that doesn't care anymore, it's not a good, does not bode well for the future.
As a PCU, I've often wondered what I could do to bring our percentages up, because we have, we might have 30-some people in the district vote on certain issues. Other times it's better. When you call them, talk to them, ask them to come to a meeting, coffee at the house or something like that. I get this. No, I don't want anything to do with it. And I don't know how to get the people going. If you write them a letter, they ignore it.
Yeah.
If you invite them to be a part of the district, they don't respond to that. And we don't even know. I mean, we don't have all of them even registered.
Yeah.
So what happens?
I'll make this the closing one, and I'll stay around for more if you want to talk informally. But that's a lot longer question, longer answer than can give right now. But I think it speaks to a lot of the direction of society. I don't remember who I was talking with the other day about disengagement of the public. It's Robert Putnam, who did a study a couple years ago about how people used to participate in bowling leagues. Now they bowl on their own. They used to go to the opera. Now they stay home and listen to something on a CD. We are much more into ourselves and much less into community involvement. And I don't think it's just politics. So it's clearly politics. We better care about our politics if we care about our future. And it's not just politics, it's the arts, it's a whole lot of things that we pay less and less attention to. We're less willing to engage in the community. It's a hard one to talk about here at Holden, where everybody participates. I mean, people come to Holden in order to participate. this is not a cross-section of the public. This is not a good cross-section of the public, but it's us who are involved, who are engaged, who have to find ways to get them involved. And you're right. I've been to so many places where, oh, a politician, and they slam the phone down if you want to talk to them, they slam the door. People tend to be polite. I mean, I go door to door. Our districts aren't that large. You can't go door to door. And people, even those who disagree with you strongly, they'll usually, oh, thank you. They'll take the book and the booklet, brochure, whatever, and smile at you. And thank you, goes the door. And nothing rude, or any Minnesotans tend to be nice. But getting them to do more than that, getting them to, oh, yeah, I agree with this guy. Getting them to do something beyond that, volunteer, get involved in whatever issues drive them. I don't care what the issues, getting them involved in something. That's something we better work about if we care about building a society and not just a group of individuals who happen to live in the same planet.
I think you're hitting on something right there, building a society. We're going to lose it. Mm-hmm. We're going to lose the democratic process if they don't get involved. And there are more of them that aren't involved than are.
Yeah, we have Minnesota, we can be proud. We've led the nation in voter turnout, but proud. One of our elected officials a couple years ago was in South Africa, the first time they had a black majority voting. And she told the story when she came back about some 80-year-old woman who standing in a long hot line in the hot sun waiting to vote. And it was clearly she had been waiting for like 2 or 3 hours and she wasn't anywhere near the front of the line. And somebody asked her, well, are you going to be okay? This is a 70-some-year-old woman standing in the heat of the sun and waiting. And she said, listen, lady, I've been waiting 70 years for this chance. I can wait a few more hours. Yeah. And we can't, you know, it's too much of a sacrifice. I don't feel like voting. We've got to get that kind of spirit back. I hope we don't ever make people wait in lines like that. We got to get that enthusiasm back. You've been a patient audience tonight, and good discussion, and I'm happy to stay around and answer more questions informally. Otherwise, I'll be around the village for a while. Thank you very much.